Welcome to The Whole Marketer, where we look at the holistic skills, the technical skills, soft skills, leadership skills, and personal understanding that marketers of today need to grow the brands and businesses of tomorrow. We're here to ensure that marketers feel supported and empowered to have successful and fulfilling careers and lives as a whole. Hello, and welcome to The Whole Marketer podcast. This episode is brought to you by Sticky Beak. I'm an advocate for consumer and customers being at the heart of our decision making, and our sponsors of today's episode can help you do just that. Sticky Beak is a platform that marketers have been dreaming of. Rapid global consumer testing to give you affordable, real-time feedback on all of your marketing activation, so you know what consumers think before you go to market and to get that all-important buy-in. Say goodbye to endless discussions and hello to faster, better decisions. Visit stickybeak.co/thewholemarketer to see how Sticky Beak are changing the way marketeers work. Today's episode is a technical skill. It's psychological biases. And before I welcome today's guest, no other than Richard Shotton, onto the podcast, let me tell you why I think it's so important for us to understand and discuss this on today's podcast. Psychological biases are patterns found in our decision making. They affect how individuals perceive, interpret, and respond to information, which often leads to errors or distortions in thinking. There are many different types of psychological biases, as I learned on today's podcast, over 100. But today we will discuss a few key biases and our guest's latest book that focuses on 16 and a half biases that he believes most impact consumers' choice and decision-making, and how we as marketers can look to address them. Today's guest is Richard Shotton, who specializes in applying behavioral science to marketing. He has worked in marketing for 24 years and helps brands such as Google, Mondelez, and Meta with their challenges. He is the author of Choice Factory, the best-selling book available in 15 languages, which explains how behavioral science can solve business challenges. His latest book, The Illusion of Choice, which we'll discuss today, came out in March 2023. In 2021, he became an associate of the Molyneux Institute, Churchill College, Cambridge University, and is an honorary fellow of the IPA. Richard, welcome to the Whole Marketer podcast.
Good to see you.
So as always, we start with a big, juicy question. And today's big, juicy question is, what are psychological biases to you?
So I would argue the best definition of psychological bias, the best definition of behavioral science comes from a wonderful psychologist called Susan Fiske. So she's at Princeton, and she describes people as cognitive misers. Now, her colleague Daniel Kahneman puts it a bit more wittily. He says, thinking is to humans as swimming is to cats. We can do it, but we'd rather not. It's not that people are stupid. They're not trying to say people aren't capable of amazing flights of logic and rationality. You know, they both work at Princeton, or Kahneman did work at Princeton. They are very well aware that people have amazing logical abilities. But their argument is that energy is a scarce resource. We have evolved to conserve energy, and thinking is energy intensive. So rather than make deep, considered decisions, whether this is in our personal or professional or consumer life, rather than think through all our options very carefully, what we tend to do is make speedy, fast, quick, reflexive decisions. Now, the way that we make those reflexive decisions, and this is where the bias starts to come in, is to use what psychologists rather pompously call heuristics, what we might just call rules of thumb. So we have a whole range of quick rules of thumb for making fast decisions. Now, those rules of thumb are prone to biases. And when we say biases here, what I mean is a deviation from what an economist might say is a rational way of behaving. Those rules of thumb tend to be prone to biases. And that should therefore be of interest to marketers, because what it means is if you're designing communications, if you're creating a product and you know about these biases, well, then you can design your products in a way that meets them, matches them, and therefore you can work with human nature rather than against it. So that's what I mean when I discuss psychological biases.
Meet them, match them, and work with them. That's what us marketers should be doing. And rules of thumb is a much better way of describing it than heuristics or biases or shortcuts.
And if we want to get a wider range of marketers aware of behavioral science, aware of these psychological biases, then we need to talk in the simplest possible terms.
And that's one of the things that I loved about your book, the illusion of choice is that you do talk about it in the simplest possible way. So you give us 16 and a half psychological biases. And for those that have already read the book, there's a bonus chapter in the middle. And within those, you've given us, and therefore, what does that mean for us? So whether that's create a shortcut, use repetition, use language, use imagery, use a two-step approach. It's really user-friendly. So I'm going to say thank you on behalf of all the marketeers in the profession for writing a book that is so easy to use and understand, which can only help us create better awareness and understanding about how we can use these rules of thumb in our marketing.
Yeah, I'm very glad you felt that. The aim of the book was to be practical and to be straightforward. So if you felt that was the case, that's a success.
Well, boom, you have definitely achieved that. So in there, you write around the 16 and a half psychological biases that influence what we buy. I'm not going to ask you to go through all of them today, because within each of those, there are different rules of thumb. We'd be here literally all day, although that'd be a very enjoyable day for me. I do encourage everyone else to go out and buy the book and read them themselves. But I'd love to hear from you about why you believe it's so important for us to understand these biases, or maybe the key biases that you feel that we really can't ignore.
Well, in terms of why it's important for marketers to use them, I think there's three big reasons. Firstly, it is a very relevant field to think about. If you think about the biggest questions that marketers are trying to answer, how do you get customers to pay a premium? How do you get them to switch from a competitor brand? How do you get people to buy more of your products? Now, all of those are questions of behavior change. So every marketer is in the business of behavior change. And all behavioral sciences is a giant catalogue of hundreds, if not thousands, of experiments into what makes for effective behaviour change. So this is as relevant a topic as you could possibly imagine. I think if you stopped most people on the street who didn't work in marketing and asked them what marketers spend their time doing, I think they would imagine that marketers immerse themselves in behavioural science and psychology because it's such a relevant topic. So that's the first thing. I think the second strength is the robustness. Now, there's an awful lot of marketing theory that is speculative or based on gut feeling or based on people's intuition. And that's a dubious ground for making big, important decisions. What's so nice about behavioral science is it's never based on speculation. Everything has to be based on peer-reviewed, observed experiments. So these findings that I cover in the book, these findings that we'll discuss today, marketers can give them genuine credibility. And then the third big strength is the range of this field. So I've got relevance, robustness, and range, the big three R's. And the range point is that behavioral science isn't one big grand Uber theory that you have to force fit your unique problem to the behavioral science solution, but rather behavioral science is a collection of thousands upon thousands of experiments. And that variety means that whatever challenge a marketer has, whatever area of marketing they work in, there will be an experiment out there that can help them. So I think you've got these three big reasons why people should be interested in behavioral science. It's relevant. It's about changing consumer behavior. It's robust. It's based on peer-reviewed evidence, not speculation. And there's this wonderful range. There are so many of these studies. There will always be one out there that can fit the challenge people have in front of them.
And what do you think are those most common challenges that marketeers are faced with?
Well, I think the challenges are things like, how do I break the habits of a customer who's not buying my product? Mm-hmm. How do I encourage a customer to pay more for my product? How do I get someone's attention? The questions that are at the very heart of marketing are questions that psychologists have been looking at for probably 130 years.
And if we've been looking at these questions for 130 years, and I know we were just talking offline about this also, why do you think there's, slow's not the right word, but not a broad sweep of all marketers using this as their methodology to get the understanding around the behavior change and the insights they need to do those tasks, to change habits, to get worth paying more for, to grab the attention?
So I think that's a great question. And I would say the time we're at now isn't necessarily typical. If you went back to the 1950s, 1960s, ad agencies would work with world-class psychologists, and people like Louis Cheskin. What happened in the 60s, and I might not get my dates completely right here, is that psychology and the use of some of these techniques fell out of fashion. So there was a book written by, I think it was Vance Packard, called The Hidden Persuaders. And this is one of the best ever-selling books in advertising. A huge popular book in the late 50s, early 60s. He reported on the claims of a consultant who said they had been running subliminal tests in a cinema. So the consultant claimed they had been flashing up words like buy Coca-Cola quicker than the eye could supposedly see between the different bits of film. Now, in a culture that was, you know, worried about reds under the bed, communist mind control, that was absolutely controversial. So it became a huge area of concern, and psychology almost became, you know, forbidden. People didn't want to use it. It became tarred by this association. So psychology used to be embedded into agencies and the creation of advertising, but fell out of fashion because of this book. Now, the irony is those claims by the consultant were garbage. Now, later journalists looked into those claims and they went back to the cinema to try and see whether there were any record of these experiments taking part. And there simply weren't. You know, it was a bogus claim by the consultant to try and drum up interest in their work. But despite that, it was a bit too late by the time the truth came out. And I think it's only over the last 20 years that we've been recovering from that, where psychology has become more and more of interest to marketers. So the last 20 years, people have started to become interested in behavioral science and psychology because I think of those reasons that I've mentioned. I still think there's far more opportunity to use these ideas than is currently happening, but people are starting to move in that direction. I think the reason, though, that it's not as embedded still as it should be is there is too great a reliance on claims data. So with some of these biases, if you go and ask someone what motivates them to change their behavior, they'll deny that they're influenced by behavioral science biases. If you set up simple test and control experiments, that's when you see the impact of the biases. And the problem is that too many organizations are over-reliant on claim data, focus groups and surveys. And I think they're a pretty poor way of understanding what genuinely motivates people.
I couldn't agree more. And it makes me think of the AFEC model, which I discovered not that long ago, I'm embarrassed to say, maybe 5 years ago, which talks about how we need to get as close as we possibly can to the actual behavior that is happening and not the stated or the claimed behavior, and conduct research in the most natural environment in the time period. I can't think of all the things in the model, but we're still doing it. We're still commissioning studies where there is room for biases or interpretation from the marketeer in the focus group, or we're looking for consumers to give us their stated or claimed behavior and then get surprised 2-3 years later when that product's been launched and it's not achieving or not being bought at the price point that a consumer said it was, as opposed to actually looking at actual behavior there for the answers, which, as you've said, has a higher degree of accuracy.
And you're absolutely right there. We're working often in marketing on the wrong model of human behavior. We think people know their own motivations and we think people are willing to express them. And because that's not the case, if we take what people say in focus groups or on surveys at face value, it sends us off in the wrong direction. Now, it would be a pretty standard belief in psychology that you've got to be very skeptical about what people say. So there's a wonderful psychologist called Timothy Wilson who works at the University of Virginia. And he has this phrase, he says, people are strangers to themselves. And what he means by that is most people do not have full introspective insight into why they do the things they do. So if you put someone on the spot and ask them, why do they buy that particular brand of lager or why do they buy that particular brand of trainer, they'll give lots of answers. But because they don't know their own motivations, many of those answers will be misleading. So it's not that people are necessarily trying to lie, but because they don't know the motivations, they end up being misleading. Psychologists term that a confabulation. So the implication for anyone listening is a greater skepticism towards claim data. If you run a survey, recognize that what people say isn't the gospel truth. And then secondly, maybe most importantly, is complement surveys and focus groups with simple test and control experiments. Now, think about your 100 stores or your website. Think about them as laboratories. You can run some of these studies that psychologists have done to get close to the truth. Now, half of the traffic see message A, half of the traffic see message B, which has just got one change from the first message, and then any difference in behavior you can attribute back to that single change variable. That would be a much more accurate guide to understanding how best to change people's behavior.
That was going to be my next question, Richard. I was going to say, so for those that are sat here listening, going, yeah, we do that. We want to be able to bring in some more robust, you know, psychological based behavioral science insight into our thinking to get that robustness and that relevancy. Where do we start? That's a great piece of advice, a test and control experiment. Can you expand a bit more for the marketer that's listening and thinking, yes, so where do I start?
Yeah, of course. So I'm going to take you through an example of an experiment I did. And this is probably the simplest way to apply that test and control approach. Researchers call it monadic testing. So again, it sounds a bit more complicated than it actually is. And essentially what you do is you recruit a group of people and then you randomize them into different groups and you show them all slightly different stimuli and then you see how they respond. So I'll give a concrete example to make it a bit clearer. Back in the run-up to me writing The Choice Factory, I ran a study amongst 500 people, randomized them into one of four groups. First group saw a picture of a car, description of a car, and then they were given the annual price. So let's say, and I'll make this number up for ease, £3,650 a year. Next group saw the description, the picture, and the monthly price, so £300 a month. Next group, picture, description, weekly price. Next group, picture, description, daily price. Now, all those amounts of money annualized to the same amount. So if people were logical, rational, considered decision makers, when we then questioned them about how good value the car was, they should have given us roughly the same answer. But that is not what happened. People who saw the car and the annual price, only 11% thought it was good value. People who saw the car and the daily price, 53%, I think, thought it was good value. So you get this massive fivefold swing in proportion of people who thought the car was good value. Is known as temporal reframing. So it's the idea that when we judge a price, we put too much emphasis on the headline amount, the $3,650 a year. We don't put enough emphasis on the amount of time, the yearly bit. So it's like we think 5 times 7 is different from 7 times 5. So that's the bias, temporal reframing. And you can apply that easily as a marketer by making sure you always convey your prices in the smallest possible time unit. So if you're a broadband provider, don't go out and say you're £30 a month. Say you're £30 a month. That's the same as £1 a day. But your question was slightly different, which was about the technique. And I was just doing that as an example to show you this technique of monadic testing and why it's so useful. Because what most marketers would do is get an individual person and show them two prices. You know, £3,650 a year, £300 a month. And they'd say to people, which do you think is better value? And people would laugh. They'd say, you know, those are exactly the same things. It would make no difference to me. But if you take this monadic approach, if you randomize people into different groups and each person only sees one of those variants, then you're getting close to the truth. This oblique approach, this element of subterfuge gets you close to the truth because people think that they are comparing description, an image versus a price. They cannot possibly know that the researcher from their bird's eye view is being able to compare how the unit of time changes people's reactions. So that's what I would call a monadic test. That is a remarkably flexible and simple approach that you can, as a marketer, apply to your surveys tomorrow. And that's, I think, a very simple thing people can add in.
I absolutely love that. It's something that's very simple and effective that even with some of the testing approaches that you might already be using within your research and insight team or yourself as a solo marketer can think, actually, it's not about asking the same human to give me the variants, but actually different groups of humans with different variants to see which one performs better.
Exactly. And the digital marketers listening are probably thinking, well, we do this all the time. The only difference to that standard A-B approach is you're not just testing the final piece of creative. And I think the danger is if you just A-B test final creatives, there is a limited shelf life to the knowledge that you gather because the creative direction changes all the time. if you test the underlying bias or the underlying driver of behavior, like social proof, temporal reframing, the pratfall effect, if you test those things in an A-B manner, well, once you find out whether they work for your brand, that's an insight that will last forever. It's suggesting taking almost a digital tactic for testing a final piece of creative and applying it to your research.
The way that you've explained that, you've made it really easy to comprehend. So thank you. And it's the same throughout your book with all the different biases. But for those that are sat here thinking, okay, so how do I start to understand what those different rules of thumb are and what might be happening within my brand as a test hypothesis situation, where would you recommend that they start?
That's a good question. So there are hundreds of these biases, so it can feel a bit confusing at first. But what psychologists and practitioners have done is create frameworks to make it easier to navigate the variety. So for example, the government back in 2010 set up a department called the Behavioural Insight Team. And the aim of that team was to try and make sure government policy drew on behavioural science. And one of the best things that group of academics and practitioners did was in 2014 create a framework called EAST. So EAST is an acronym and it stands for make it easy, make it attractive, make it social and make it timely. Now, these are the big four principles of behavioural science. So I would recommend people use one of these frameworks as a way of categorising the behavioural biases that are out there. So, for example, make it social. That is the idea that people, they don't make decisions as discrete individuals, but they tend to look around to what others do. So we are deeply influenced by the behavior of the crowd. If we can make our product look like it's popular, that product will become more appealing, and more people are likely to buy it. Now, as ever, that isn't based on speculation. There are hundreds of experiments out there that show this principle of social proof. Probably the most famous one is a 2008 study from Robert Cialdini. So he is professor of marketing at Arizona State University. And in his study, works with a hotel chain in Southwest USA and persuades that hotel chain to let him alter the messages running in guest rooms, encouraging them to reuse their towels. So he randomizes the rooms into three groups. First group see the basic message. This is a door hanger in their room, which says, please reuse your towels. It's good for the environment. 35% of people do so. Next set of rooms, Cialdini changes that door hanger message, gets rid of any logical, rational reason for complying. And instead, he makes it clear what most people do. Now, he uses social proof. The message now says, please reuse your towels. Most guests do so. And there you see a 26% improvement in towel reuse rates. We're up to 44% of people reusing their towels. What Cialdini's shown there is if you want to change behavior, it's often more effective to emphasize what others are doing rather than giving people a long list of rational reasons for changing. So focus on demonstrating the popularity of your brand. With Cialdini's study, there are always nuances, and he ran a third variant of the message in which he tested a hypothesis. And his hypothesis was that we are most influenced by people like ourselves. So the final set of rooms changes the door hanger message one more time. And now he says, please reuse your towels. Most guests who've stayed in this room have done so. Now that is a weak link with the audience, but even that tenuous link boosts compliance further. And in that setup, you get 49% of people reusing their towels. That's a 40% improvement in the control. What Cialdini's shown here is for social proof, you don't just want to use the largest possible number at your disposal as a brand. You don't just want to talk about your million customers. You want to identify facts about the audience and then tell them that you are popular amongst that particular group. So if you're talking to Londoners, better to say you have 100,000 customers in London rather than 1 million customers in the UK. That's tailored social proof. So there you can see this point of framework will categorize all the different biases into different groups, makes it easy to manage, easy to access this data. And then for each of those underlying principles, you've then got these experiments that prove the idea, give you very clear recommendations on what to do as a marketer, but also start to bring out some of the nuances to the idea.
There's two things that come out as I'm listening to you. The first is it always comes down to that human need around the want to be liked and loved. You know, just by reusing your towels means that you're going to be as liked, if not more liked, than the previous guest that was historically in your room. and actually how that has so much influence, even on a small change, than potentially all the facts that you could have shared and the relevancy of those facts in those situations.
I love your use of the word or the phrase human need. And I think you're absolutely right there. There's something fundamental here. You know, if you approach this from an evolutionary angle, being accepted by a group is fundamental to our survival. You know, humans are a weak animal when we are on our own. You know, we don't have tusks, we don't have claws, we don't have venom or poison. But you put us together in a group and we act together and we are the most powerful animal on the planet. So our survival has very much throughout evolutionary history been dependent on us firstly recognizing what other people want and then fitting in with those desires. You know, you go back to ancient Greece and they used to have the punishment of ostracism. You would be ejected from the group, sent out on your own. That was a death penalty. So you're absolutely right. There is a human need, I think, to identify as part of a group. And then we feel a very strong pressure to live up to the expectations and the norms of that group. So the argument from a commercial perspective would be, don't try and overturn these deep-seated parts of human nature. No one's got the ability to do that or the budget to do that. What you've got to do is accept the operating software that humans have and then try and work with that to get to your end.
That's such a great piece of advice, working with the operating system that you have. And I also love the way that you've described that need for us to belong as well, and how ostracism, thank you, was actually seen as a form of punishment. The thing that separates us from mammals is our want to be liked and loved and that be part of that community. So yeah, it's profound as to the impact that it has.
Yeah, and you can see it's not just commercial problems where you can use this principle. So there is an awful lot of social good advertising sometimes misuses some of these biases. So if you think about a lot of government advertising, they talk about the prevalence of unwanted behaviour. Now, loads of people don't turn up to their doctor's appointment. Loads of youths carry knives. Loads of students get drunk. They try and emphasize the scale of the problem to shock people into changing their behavior. The problem is, from a social proof perspective, that is exactly the wrong thing to do. Because if you stress lots of people turn up late or drink loads or carry knives, you are emphasizing the commonplaceness of the bad behavior. You know, the argument from social proof is that will remove a sense of transgression and make that behavior more likely to occur. You know, we tend to copy what other people do. Now, that's not me speculating. There is a brilliant set of studies, again by Robert Cialdini. It's a 2003 study where he works with a national park in America. This is the Arizona Petrified Wood National Park. And he's picked this park because loads of people are stealing bits of petrified wood as a souvenir. And Cialdini tests what happens if you tell other visitors about the scale of theft. So he monitors theft rates with CCTV cameras. He sprinkles bits of wood in a deserted bit of the park. Anyone going down through that bit of park has the opportunity to steal a bit of wood. And when he puts up the CCTV cameras, he sees that 2.9% of people steal a bit of wood. He then puts up a sign saying 12 tons of wood's been stolen each year and it's ruining the look of the path. Please don't steal. When he does that, there is an almost tripling of theft rates. So 7.9% of people steal a bit of wood in that condition. Just as social proof suggests, if you emphasize that a behavior is commonplace, you make that behavior more likely to occur. So yes, commercial brands can use social proof. They can go out and say their lager is very popular or their accountancy software is used by millions of people. But also people who are working with the government or charities need to heed social proof as well. And I think the first thing they need to do is recognize that, be very, very careful about inadvertently using social proof in the wrong direction. Be very careful not to emphasize the scale of the behavior you don't want to occur.
That makes complete sense. I was thinking, as you were describing all of these people have stolen a bit of wood, I was thinking, well, then if everyone's stealing it, why wouldn't I?
Yeah, it can't be that bad if everyone's doing it. Oh, I better get some before it all goes. Yeah, there are lots of ideas that it plants in people's heads.
And also, you know, trying to change the behavior of a tribe as one voice when that tribe's behavior is constantly being compounded as well. When you're describing the drinking within students, for example.
Yeah, the interesting thing with drinking is also we often don't have an accurate behaviour of what the common occurrence is. So if you think about drinking on campus, if 10 people walk soberly across the courtyard in the middle of the campus, they're not really noticed. If one drunken idiot is falling around, swearing, shouting, vomiting, that person is noticed. And the problem is that our perception of what is the norm of behaviour is what is visible and noticeable. So we judge the commonplace behaviour by how easy we can remember an instance happening. And if the drunkenness is highly visible and the soberness is hidden away, people have a mistaken belief in terms of what's the normal behaviour. So as a government or a university management team, you want to be emphasising the real occurrence of soberness. You want to be focusing on rebalancing people's misperceptions. So I think there is something interesting here about how often people are mistaken on what they think the norm of behaviour is. And maybe as a marketer or someone trying to change behaviour, first thing you could do is investigate whether or not the populace have got the correct idea about your popularity. And if they haven't, that's something you want to address.
That's a great piece of advice. And one thing I have to ask on behalf of the listeners, where do they go for those frameworks?
So that there's a couple they might want to think about. Robert Cialdini wrote a brilliant book called Influence, in which he has his own framework. He essentially identifies the six key principles of persuasion. EAST is a very good one. You know, if people Google EAST framework BIT, that is a very good summation of some of the key principles. And then what I've tried to do in the choice factor and the illusion of choice is pick the biases that I think are most relevant for marketers. So today we've ended up talking a lot about social proof. That's one of the principles discussed. Across the other two books, there's an awful lot of other ones.
So you heard it here first from Richard Shotton. That's where you need to go and find your frameworks. So thank you so much for everything you shared so far and all of your examples and case studies. I'd love to learn a little bit more about you and your personal career by hearing your career highs and lows.
Career high is easy. That's probably setting up on my own. So after I wrote The Choice Factory, people began to contact me and asked if I would apply some of these principles to their brands. So I went part-time, stopped working at the agency that I was at, went part-time, set my own company called Astro 10. Eventually, that became a full-time job. And now there's four of us working with lots of different brands, applying these principles of behavioral science. So that's definitely the career high. I think the interesting thing with the lows is I spent an awful lot of my 20s being stressed about work, being worried about what clients thought of me, were they happy with the latest proposal? And I think with the benefit of hindsight, most of the things I stressed about in the end, when you look back, weren't really that consequential. So I think the low was allowing what were really minor hiccups along the way make me feel quite so uncomfortable. There are a few quotes along that line. I mean, it probably was never actually said by him, but it's always attributed. There's this brilliant one from Churchill who said, say, late on in life, supposedly, you know, I had many worries in my life, most of which never happened. And I would say that describes my 20s remarkably well. Stressed about things that in retrospect really weren't that important.
Well, hindsight and retrospect are a wonderful thing,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yes.
I always say it's never in the learning, it's on the reflection on the learning. And as I'm listening to you, I'm listening to someone who quite clearly cares about the quality and the impact of your work and is passionate about it. And that's why those two things probably culminated together in your 20s. And although that continues now throughout the rest of your life, maybe your perspective on it has changed as you've got more proof points.
Yeah, my wife always used to say to me, you know, well, what's the worst could happen? Think about the response you put in is absolutely hated. You know, what's the worst that could happen? Well, the client wants to work with someone else. Well, what's the worst that would happen then? And that was quite good, I think, her getting me to think about the worst possible scenario in that situation. And actually, the worst possible thing wasn't that awful. That, I think, always really helped me in trying to put things in perspective. But it's easy knowing something in theory. It takes a long time, I think, to learn to put it into practice.
I couldn't agree more. And catastrophizing the methodology that you described there, I think are people like, oh, I always take myself to the worst place. I'm like, it's actually a coping mechanism and actually quite effective for many people. You know, take yourself to the worst case scenario. Once you've placed yourself there and actually realize there's a way out or a way that you would cope or how you would resolve it, that actually the here and now isn't going to be half as bad as we imagine.
Especially when we're working marketing, like if we were in the army or if we were in the medical services, you could catastrophize to a pretty bad place. But frankly, for most of us, for most of the time, the worst possible scenario isn't that awful. And I found the recognition of that, I found that super useful. I guess everyone's got to find their own coping mechanism. But for me, that was the ideal one.
Definitely. Perspective against the world. That's why it's so important to go into nature every day and see the trees still grow and the sun still shines today, just briefly. But, you know, those things still happen in amongst the world in which we as marketeers operate. So you've given us so much great advice throughout today's podcast, Richard, and it's been a pleasure to have you. What one piece of advice would you give to marketers of tomorrow?
I would say immerse yourself in the world of behavioral science. It has a lot of benefits. We've talked about the robustness. And so it's going to give you insights that have firm foundations to come up with the ideas. The other benefit is these ideas are evergreen. So the principles don't fade in out of fashion. And I think if you learn them in 2024, well, they'll still be useful in 2064. And that's phenomenally valuable. An awful lot of time and effort amongst marketers is expended on, you know, the latest fad and the latest fashion, something that we'll get a great knowledge about, but in 6 months, it'll be out of date. I think if we put a greater proportion of efforts into these fundamentals, we will recoup the benefits later on in our careers.
Great piece of advice, especially for things that have the longevity so that we don't have to keep redoing them.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much again for your time on today's podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to chat. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning into the Whole Marketer podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do like, follow, and share. The Whole Marketer is here to support and empower you and your teams with the latest technical skills, soft and leadership skills and behaviors, and personal understanding for a successful, fulfilling marketing career and life as a whole. For support, resources, and more information on how we can help you to become a Whole Marketer and build whole marketing teams, go to www.thewholemarketer.com.